For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
阅读、科技、旅行，生活可以很大。对话设计、学习、思考不嫌太多。这里是 iTunes 获奖播客《狗熊有话说》，一听就停不下来的哦。Hello， 你好，欢迎收听独立知识型脱口秀《狗熊有话说》（Bear Talk）， 我是大狗熊。大狗熊，我在新西兰工作两年多，那么算是很幸运，在一落地新西兰就找到了工作。但上个月呢，我离职了。那么更多呢，是希望自己能够回归到跟设计和这个交互相关的领域。那么现在我给自己定的一个大的方向呢，是 UX and UI Designer。 那么这样的一个方向，其实很多之前我在国内积累的一些经验呢，虽然可以用，但更多需要学习新的技能、新的知识，然后也需要去适应一个全新的环境。那么感觉又是很多东西又重新清空，从头再来的感觉。那么因为自己对新西兰这个市场，就是对科技的这个领域呢，其实还是需要多一些了解。那么我觉得自己在这方面还很欠缺，最好的方式呢，就是多咨询一些行业里面的高手和专家。那么这也是为什么我今天请到了这期节目的嘉宾来和我分享一下他作为一个非新西兰本国的一个移民来到这里工作生活，而且时间很短，那么他的经验和心得呢，其实对我很有启发。今天这期节目呢，是一期英文的采访节目，但语速很慢，如果你在英文收听方面能够跟得上的话，其实会有很大的启发。今天的嘉宾啊，叫做 Lucas Coelho， 那么他来自于巴西，但在美国工作过一段时间然后呢现在呢是在新西兰，其实来新西兰时间也就一年多。那么他目前呢是Royal Creative 这家公司的设计总监 Head of Design。然后呢在巴西的时候，他也是 TEDx 的一个演讲者。那么他还有一个身份呢，是新西兰奥克兰本地的这个交互设计师联盟，叫Interaction Designer Foundation。 那么这个组织我也是其中的一个 member， 也是一个成员。那他是奥克兰本地的这个组织的领导者是一个非常有意思的人。那么他在这期节目里面呢，分享了很多自己从如何进入到一个英文为主要交流语言的这个工作环境如何作为设计师如何汲取不同的养分，如何成长，都给出了很多很好的建议。那么在这个 brief 里面呢，我简单的说一下。那比如说他和我分享的第一个经验，就是如何能够适应和学习纯英文的这种工作的环境。那么他作为在巴西生活成长的人呢，他讲的话是葡萄牙语，那么来到去到美国的话是以英语为交流。那么和我之前在入职的时候感觉一样就是头一段时间你会觉得每天精力都 被消耗的特别大，因为用一个非母语的语言进行高强度的交流呢，其实是非常消耗精力的。那么他也分享了自己的一些经验。另外呢，还有比如说像这个如何能够持续的进步。那么作为设计师呢，最好的方式呢，就是收听一些跟设计领域相关的播客，那么可以进行很好的学习。另外在工作实战中其实他也鼓励我们，这也鼓励我说这个设计方面的学位这些没有那么重要，那么更重要的是 learning by doing， 也就是你需要去实战，在实战的过程中呢，多去积累工作经验和实际经验，然后呢把它运用到自己的项目和这个工作中。那么这一点呢，其实要比具体去学一个理论的知识，考一个学位要重要的多。另外呢，如果要做一个很好的 UX 设计师，用户体验设计师的话，一定要 connecting with people， 多和人交流多和人互动，去知道真实用户的真实需求，那么才能够做出好的产品或者是服务。 OK， 那么废话不多说了，接下来就来一起收听一下我和 Lucas 在这期节目里面我们聊的一些话题。
Hello guys, this is the new episode of podcast Bear Talk, and it's been a while since I produced the last episode, and today we're gonna do an English interview again. So I have a guest today, and he is an UX expert. And also, he's the head of the design at Rome Creative, yeah, and also a TED TED speaker, the local leader of Auckland IDF International Design Foundation Group, yeah, and he has a lot of hats as a product manager, UX strategist, and also a growth hacker, yeah.And also his education background is really, how to say that, with also dynamic, with also a lot of different experience in different fields. And he worked for large companies, global companies, and startup companies, and also government agencies.Things like that. So I think his experience will be really helpful if you want to learn something about UX and UI design. And also for me, I've learned a lot last time when I met with him, when I had a lunch with him, and also a lot of inspiration and valuable advices from him for me. Okay, so.Long story short, let's just introduce the guest, Lucas. And could you tell me more about yourself? Could you introduce yourself, Lucas?
Yeah. Hello, Bear. Happy to be here, having this chat. Yeah, I think you spoke a lot about me already. And been working with design technology and interested in lots of fields. I believe that's potentially what make me understand better design, was looking at other fields and seeing how can I apply that to deliver better experiences to people. So I think if I can, if I could speak a little bit about myself more, I would just say I'm a very curious person. So I always look at things and try to figure out how things work and how the world works and how people...understand things or how we can improve lives of people, and that's what yeah. drives me, and what took me here.
So actually there are a bunch of questions I would like to ask, but the first one I think is probably it's quite an easy question, but I think it's very important for all the audience of my podcast because you are not an English native speaker, right?
Yes.
So same as me and same as a lot of other guys who are listening. So how did you just came here as a UX designer? So you came from Brazil.
Yeah.
And so what's the career path and how did you overcome the incompetence of communicate with other one with English speakers, and how did you just get a job at first in an English speaking country? So how did you start from all the beginning?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I always had interest in the English language, I guess. So I remember the first in Brazil, it's very common to learn English at school. So usually around 8-10 years old, mm-hmm. you start having English classes at school. They're very basic, but
so you're right. What's the average level of English in Brazil?
It's not very high. So I would say it's high, but I know that I'm looking inside my bubble of friends. So mm-hmm. inside my friends, they're all working technology, or I'll work with innovation, or they're all in this field. So they all kind of speak English, mm-hmm. but Brazil, it's a huge country as China. So I think there's potentially not a lot of people that speaks English in Brazil. I can say from friends, from English native friends, when they go to Brazil to visit me, they always complain like, wow, no one speaks English in Brazil. And and I'm always trying to defend, no, there's a lot of people that speak English. And then I need to step back and think about it. I'm like, yeah, that's true. Brazil is a huge country.
Yeah.
It's still a third world country. We're getting there. So there's still a lot of people that don't speak English. But I was privileged to have the basis of the English education on in my school when I was growing up, and then that's just sparked my curiosity. As I was saying, I'm very curious people, mm-hmm. a person. So I started to. I remember a lot of things that I did was watching Friends, the TV show.
Yeah. Same. I did the same thing.
Yeah, and I love to watch Friends and repeat. When I listen to something, I saw that translation, I know what it meant. Mm-hmm. I like to repeat that over what the character said, just to see if I could find a good accent or a good accent of English. That sounded really natural for me. That's mm-hmm. That's probably not a very accurate New York accent, but it sounded right to me as an English. Mm-hmm. A person speaking. So I always try to repeat that. I was never really a fan of learning through songs.
Mm-hmm.
I think I studied music since I was a kid. So voice for me in music is just another instrument. So I rarely pay attention to what lyrics they're singing. For me, it's just another instrument that is making the composition. But podcasts are, since we're speaking here, podcasts is something that really, really helped. Not when I was a kid, podcast is fairly recent, but listening to US podcasts also improved my English a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And also speaking with people that speak English. So when I was 2011, when I started looking at the startup world, a lot of things. A lot of good material, especially on the startup field that was emerging in Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
It was still in English, mm-hmm. so I needed to learn how to speak English. There was no other way that I could read Lean Startup or a couple of those other books or blogs from those people, from Eric Ries. Or if I wanted to drink straight from the source, I needed to become better in English. So I just pretty much started almost exclusively reading in English and watching videos in English and everything I could, just to make me more familiarized of listening and not translating in my mind,
mm-hmm.
just listening and absorbing it and replying.
Mm-hmm.
And still to this day, I know there's a lot of sentences that I know how to speak because I listened before on a context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I know the context where the, especially some slangs or some things. Mm-hmm. Some, I use the slang exactly as the way that I listen to because I kind of know what context it should be used. Sometimes yeah. Sometimes it's not very accurate, but then I ask the person, oh, what did I do wrong?
Yeah.
But
it's like you build the right mental map
yeah.
in your mind about how to use that correctly.
Yeah, mm-hmm. but it's just, I think not being afraid also helped. So in 2014, when I was, already was fairly good in English, but it was from just practicing myself, but I started chatting a lot with what was when I got in touch with them college. So it was a US startup, you know, we started working together and I loved the, we did lots of calls anywhere from San Francisco, and then just by speaking with them and not being afraid to speak,
mm-hmm.
My English improved. Mm-hmm. So I think one thing that helped me build that confidence was faking confidence at the beginning. So it was like, yeah, I can speak English. Yeah, and then
until you make
yeah,
it.
Yeah, and I was like speaking English. And then sometimes, and I always said, if I say something wrong, can you correct me? I'm completely comfortable receiving feedback.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like, can you correct me? And then while doing these calls, when I went to do San Francisco, the same thing. It was like, can you correct me every time I speak something wrong? And then that just ended up building confidence. And then after a few years, when I got my company to run workshops.
How long for you to keep this like practical practice during the stop off?
Good question. Every day.
Well,
I need to try a bit of every day. Mm-hmm. I really believe on consistency.
Mm-hmm.
So there is one thing that I don't remember who said that. I believe it was Tony Robbins, but I believe I listened to, what is his name? To Tim Ferriss. I listened to the Tim Ferriss show, Tim Ferriss podcast. And one time he mentioned a quote that stayed with me that was, everyone knows how to get fit, right? You need just to exercise, sleep well, and eat well.
Yeah.
Everyone knows how to do that. Why not everybody has a nice body and a perfect health? Because people fail to do that consistently.
Yeah.
So if you take small steps every day, but you take them every day, you're gonna get better, but you need to do them. You need to create a habit. You need to, no matter what, I'm gonna do this every day.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's one thing that I speak with often. And I don't believe in that, and I often read about that. But a mentor once told me that motivation is for amateurs. It's like motivations for amateurs.
Mm-hmm.
For us, we just show up and do whatever we need to do consistently every day.
Mm-hmm.
And that stuck with me. And it was like, yeah, that's true. Like, it was like, every person that wants to get better, how do they get better? They just a deliberate practice. You just practice a bit every day, no matter what. And
that's right.
You don't miss a day.
Mm-hmm.
Even that's 10 minutes a day. How do you get better at meditating? I try to meditate every day. How do you get better at meditating every day, even if it's 10 minutes, 5 minutes every day?
Mm-hmm.
You're going to get better at playing guitar. How do you get better at playing guitar? You play every day.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't need to be 2 hours straight, because sometimes people try to compensate and binge.
Yeah.
You binge practice and then you get tired and you don't practice for another week.
Yeah, that's right.
That don't usually work. Like, you need to, even though it's 15 minutes every day,
mm-hmm.
just 15 minutes, you grab a guitar, you practice, do the same practice, you're going to improve. Guarantee you're going to be better at everything. You just stay to the habit of deliberate practice and things. Yeah.
That's right. That's a lot of people just make their New Year's resolutions, like getting fit, and then
probably went to the gym, practiced for 2 hours, and just exhausted, totally exhausted, and then lay on the couch for the next 2 months.
Yeah.
And yeah, did that. So never accomplish, never keep doing it every day. Yeah, it's like, it's also, I had a similar experience the year before last. That's the second year when I moved to New Zealand, and my baby, my daughter Molly, was just born. So the first year was like a chaos for the family, without any family, without other family member to take care of her, and we have to do things by our own. So my sleep was terrible, and I don't have time to do exercise. I was quite kind of like sick, unhealthy at that time. And then I think probably need to do something to improve, but I still can't find a bunch of time to do exercise or things like that. And I just said to myself, let's start with a cold water shower in the morning. So because I got a lot of, I caught a lot of flu at that time, so I think it's a good way to start from that. Just take 2 minutes. I don't have any excuse to not doing that, right? And also, it's great to build a mental toughness.
Yeah.
And then I keep doing that. At first, just so easy to, and I found it's really hard at first to make the right, to make the decision. You know, it's just the decision: cold water or hot water. But at first, you just so hard to turn it to the cold water position. So, and take me at least 2 or 3 weeks, and with a lot of failing experience. But then I think after 1 month, I got I just built a habit. You know, no matter how cold it was, I just turn the cold water tap, and then probably sometimes just take 1 minute shower, sometimes 3 minutes. But and after 1 month, I just I can do that automatically in the morning, and then I hold it for till now. I still do that every morning. Yeah, it's like a great way, and I totally agree that consistency is how you do that.
But, yeah, it's like Aristotle used to say, that has that quote, that's probably his quote, that is, excellence is not an act, it's a habit.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're not, excellence is not achieved by doing something just one time, just once.
That's
you need to create the habit of doing something consistently until you master it.
Mm.
And to your point, like even something like a cold shower,
mm-hmm.
it might be annoying at first, but then you're building the habit, and probably now you don't mind it. You actually enjoy it.
Yeah.
So it just makes part of your day, who you are.
Yeah. At the beginning, probably really uncomfortable, but that's right. So,
but it's the same with gym, right? It's the same with healthy eating.
Yeah.
Like, there's the Tim Ferriss, I think I listened to him saying, and I completely agree, that people are really good at choosing their goals, but they're not good at choosing their struggles. And then, but you need to choose your struggles as much as to choose your goals. Like when you look and say, okay, my goal is to become a doctor, right?
Mm-hmm.
To save people's lives. Yeah, that's your goal. But you also need, when you choose your goal, you're also choosing 8 years of studying, nights awake, testing, dealing with cadavers until you can become a doctor. So you need to be aware of all the struggles that you're taking as well as a goal. Like people just want to get fit, but they are not counting that they're going to need to restrict your calories, work out very often, not go to drinks every day or parties, or binge drink or binge eating.
Mm-hmm.
Like people want to get rich, but they're not, but they don't want to work late hours if it's needed to, or sometimes not go to a party because they need to deliver something the next day, or it's just the choices you make. And when you choose a goal, you're also choosing the struggles that you need to go through.
achieve that
whole package. You can't just take one part of it, just take it as a whole thing.
That's why we're very bad at planning. Mm. And look at the future. We only look at the goals. We don't look at the struggles.
Mm.
And every time, if we look at the struggles, you know, we need to be aware of, because the struggles are the triggers that make us not sustain a habit.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like you say, I want to work out every day. Okay, so think about the struggles. Yeah, it's going to hurt
mm-hmm.
at first. You're going to be very sore.
Mm-hmm.
You might wake up someday. Time might be a problem some days.
Mm.
What happens if it's raining?
Mm.
Are you going to go when it's raining? And you need to mentally prepare to go and look at all those triggers so they don't come to you like something that you didn't predict it.
Mm-hmm.
Like if it's, you wake up at 6 a.m. and it's raining and it's cold, you're like, yep, I thought about that. I'm going to go anyways.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're just going to look and say, no, today, I'm going to go today, tomorrow, I'll wake up tomorrow.
Yeah. So that's a common issue for everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah. And speaking of when you first get experience of working in an English environment,
yeah.
So what was the biggest challenge at first for you to work in a second language environment?
My biggest challenge was how tired I was after a day of work.
Mm.
Because even when you're working or when you're speaking with a language, we're listening a lot in a language that is not your natural language,
mm-hmm.
you get so mentally exhausted.
Yeah.
Because it's not your as thinking fast and slow, Daniel Kahneman, but it's not your system one that's processing that, it's on your system two. So you need to think a lot about what you're going to say sometimes, mm-hmm. or how you're going to form sentences, or you forget about a question. And then the amount of energy that your brain or body uses to be engaged and keeping your energy high, mm-hmm. understand everyone and speak in a way that people understand, it's enormous.
Mm.
So I remember when I started, I was going to go to meetings, and if I had back-to-back meetings, I would be at the bed at 7 p.m.
Mm.
And by the end of the day, it still happens to me sometimes. By the end of, if I have a day full of workshops or conversations,
mm-hmm.
by 6 p.m. Or 7 p.m., for me, it's very hard to speak English. Sometimes I just switch back to Portuguese,
mm-hmm.
like naturally, without thinking about it. Mm. And then I'm like, really sorry, I need to switch back to English. So that's something that I think, maybe it gets better with time. It's definitely better than what it was years ago, what it was even when I arrived in New Zealand. But it's something that I need to be aware of, the amount of energy that I still need to deal with when I'm speaking English,
mm-hmm.
especially when you are in a meeting and then you go like, so you can use the language, the natural English way of speaking, like you're speaking with your peers, it needs to be a bit more formal,
mm-hmm.
and you go like, all right, so I need to think about how to be more formal in English, how I'm gonna talk about that.
Yeah.
And then that's a lot of effort.
Yeah, totally agree. And I have this exactly the same feeling 2 years ago when I started to work in the New Zealand company, Kiwi company, and I think the first week is really exhausted. So especially during the meetings, you know, and especially during the con call or Skype meeting, because it's not in person, so could be the audio qualities maybe not that good,
mm-hmm.
and people used to speak quite fast if they are already a native speaker, so it's quite hard to catch up. But how did you overcome it? Just by time, or
I think it was by time. I don't remember the moment specifically, but listening to podcasts, because there are people chatting about things, it definitely helped.
Mm.
Especially some of those, not, couple of those most famous podcasts are very well edited in a way that you can understand what everyone is speaking, but there's a couple of more indie podcasts that they're just speaking one on top of each other, and then I love those ones because then you could just listening to it and say, all right, so this is just a general conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Usually like nerd pop culture podcasts, when they're talking about a movie or something, that they're just wisecrack podcasts, they're awesome.
Yeah.
But just people having a general conversation, different accents, and then
mm-hmm.
I think you get more used to listening to more than one person speaking at the same time, and in that dynamic environment that usually a meeting is.
Mm-hmm.
So that definitely helps.
Mm.
And I think it's just practice. It's just being thrown into meetings, and then you get a slightly better.
Mm-hmm.
My wife, for example, she came with me to New Zealand. She didn't used to work with in English before, so her first full-time job in English where she needed to be good at communication was in New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
She already had a very good understanding of English, but listening and speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And she's still afraid of, she was still, until a couple of months ago, afraid of speaking at the phone with
me
someone.
Yeah.
Because she's like, I
exactly.
can't understand. And I was like, but you're not going to improve if you don't do it.
Yeah, that's right.
You just need to do it. And if you don't understand, you need to say to the person, sorry, I couldn't understand what you said. Can you repeat, please?
Mm.
Sorry, I couldn't understand. Can you repeat, please? And say, because if I make all the calls for you, you're not going to get better at this.
Mm.
And then she started doing that. She started listening to ebooks and podcasts. And now she's like, oh, yeah, now I can go to the meetings and the business meetings, and I can kind of understand
mm-hmm.
more than 80% of what they're talking about. And I'm like, oh, that's
yeah,
that's great. So it's just a practice, yeah.
Yeah, improvement. And also, yeah, practice, consistent practice out of your comfort zone.
Yeah.
Yeah, and facing the struggle. Just, yeah, that's the basic principles.
Yeah, magic doesn't happen inside your comfort zone.
Yeah,
it's usually,
right.
yeah,
mm.
it's usually outside. Yeah.
And also, because you worked in United States before, and
yeah.
then you came to New Zealand. So, do you think the cultural difference is that big? Because I think probably it's quite big challenge when you first working like in Brazil, and then went to. The United States, probably that's quite a big difference. But how about working in America and then work here in New Zealand? Do you think because they are all English speaking environment, but is there a big difference, do you think?
Yeah, so we used to have clients in the US, in America, but we went to US to do a couple of workshops and to engage with them, but we were not full-time in the US. We worked back from them, so we almost like did a remote job for them, but we engaged them in heaps of moments.
Yeah.
But on the moments that we work full-time, and by working full-time and then even remotely, the culture is different than the New Zealand culture a lot. I think the New Zealand culture is more similar to, potentially more similar to what we have in Brazil, in some places, especially Rio. People are a bit more relaxed, and I think their work-life balance is better
yeah.
than what it is in the US. In the US, they have that culture of, especially in San Francisco, Silicon Valley, where majority of our clients were from. They had the culture of growth and insane growth, and you need to ship things fast and work as much as you can and hustle.
Mm-hmm.
That I gotta say, it's quite addictive. So you get to used to that pretty fast,
mm-hmm.
but it's not a sustainable culture for. It was not very a sustainable culture for my company that was my last company that was working with them with the US, and it's definitely not a sustainable culture for big companies. So as well as there are a couple of companies in the US, they're now looking more to to improve this work-life balance. New Zealand, I think it's ahead of the US in that sense. So people here in New Zealand, they know what they need to do in work. They deliver what it needs to be delivered, but they're not going to sacrifice their well-being to get something done at work. And I deeply admire that. That's one of the reasons why I decided to come to New Zealand. I think Canada has a similar culture, a similar work ethic as New Zealand. A couple of the European countries as well. But New Zealand, it's really good at that.
Mm. Yeah. And that's speaking of the, I noticed you have some experience of freelance work.
Yeah.
So do you think? So let's start from the beginning. How did you start a freelance as or how do you regard freelance for how it helped your whole career, and then how do you switch from freelance to other startup or get employed by other companies. So the story behind it.
I got to freelance. I started freelancing really early. When I started making websites when I was younger, like figuring out how to make like horrible blogs, sort of websites for people.
Yeah.
I already started freelancing, so telling people, yeah, I can do websites for you, very cheap, and then it just as a way to practice.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I start joining the startup movement and getting to know people inside the startup community in Brazil and abroad, I start seeing, especially when you're starting your startup, that there's not a lot of money that comes from your startup at first.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was like, yeah, I have a couple skills here. I know how to code. I know how to do design. So I might as well just do a couple of things just to raise a bit of money.
Mm-hmm.
And I think 100% of the jobs that I had came from networking, from people that I already knew, or the people that knew me and is like and knew someone that needed my skills.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just connected with them. If you deliver a good job, they're going to connect you with someone else that knows how to do that needs the skills that you have. And then that's how it happened. And then after a while, you do freelancing for someone.
Mm-hmm.
And then they ask you to join the company.
Mm-hmm.
Like my last design studio, I started freelancing for them as a service designer. I'm doing a bit of copywriting as well, UX writing. And then after working with them for a while, they were like, yeah, well, we think you should join us as a partner. You have a really good set of skills that are going to be valuable for our studio. And then I decided to join. But they came mostly from, I'm trying to think about one that wasn't from networking, but the majority of them was. One thing that was cool is that from just going to startup events, I met, I have a lot of care of him. He's a really good old friend, a person that worked in the agency field for a long time, but he was like a independent consultant doing his own stuff, and then he carried me along with him to a lot of products. He knew a lot of people, and then he carried me along with him to tons of projects with big companies, small companies. Like we did from building business model from startups to the ground, that he used to do that, he used to consult on that, to working with Discovery Channel or working with like a couple of big brands that already knew him, and then he had the networking.
Yeah.
But it was a very good hub for me to he always got the job and get me part of the job to execute, which was great. Like he actually gave me a really good financial security for a while, just having that consistent sort of client, because he paid me, so he was my client, but he had other clients, so he was the connector, the hub that just gave me
the major 80% of the
he was like my manager. He probably received a big cut of my job, but after a while he started calling him an agency, a collective. He had sort of a collective, and then I started receiving a lot of jobs. A couple of them I needed to decline. I was like, well, I don't have time. If I do this, I don't have time to focus on on my own product, on my startup or my company. So I need to stop it for a while. But it was from knowing people just to getting out there and seeing what you can do and meeting people that that need something you do. I see a lot of people as well, friends of mine that's still freelance. I see them sometimes posting on Twitter, like they have a good Twitter community that already knows their work, or LinkedIn. They're like, yeah, so this is what I can do. I freelance. You guys need something? Let's chat. And then they receive a few contacts from just to bring out there what they can do, and kind of advertising what they can do to the world using their own channels. There's usually someone on your network that knows someone that needs something to be done and can pay to a big agency to do it, or a big company, design company. So
The reason I'm asking this question about freelance, how to start a freelance, or is that important to start a freelance, is about another question, how to start it, a UX or UI or a design career. Because I noticed some people, like some students or before they have no education background of this field, probably thought it could be essential to get a diploma or a degree or certificate, design related, and then you can put on a really good CV resume and also get interview from big companies or small companies and get hired and start your career like that. But I noticed, just like you, what you said before, this like a lot of interviews or job opportunities just by reference, just by referral, someone you already know, or you know who, you know what is he's capable to do. So already built some trust before. And I think freelance or just this kind of a startup project is a perfect way to start. But also, I thought some people just don't have the balance is also could be a problem, because some freelance just get a job on Upwork or some freelance platform like that and don't have any communication, doesn't meet new people, so just finish the job and get paid, and that could be not the right freelance what we are talking about. Right, so the freelance should be get you you have a break in your hand to knock the door. It's just like that. And so the question I really want to ask is how to get started the design career. So do you think freelance is a way, and if it is not, what the suggestion you would advise to start a design related career?
Freelance is one of the ways, but I think it's what it comes, it's not freelance. The freelancing, the act itself, is the essence behind that. That is the learn by doing part of the essence. So for me, I don't have a degree. I dropped out college. I don't have any diploma whatsoever that would be useful for design. I usually was A few years ago, I was usually refraining from calling myself a designer because I had this stigma of, well, I don't have a diploma in design, so I'm probably not a designer.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that's a valid argument for stopping people to, if you design a product, if you're involved in the influence of designing a product, you are a designer. If you're designing something that gets to the hands of people and deliver value to people, you are a designer. Anyone can be a designer.
Yeah.
If you just apply a couple of the basic principles of design to your day-to-day work and get consistent and get to the habit of consistently working with design if you're starting on. So I got a little confused. Let me start again. So I think it's learned by doing. It's the way that you do.
Yeah.
So you need to go out and meet people.
Mm.
It's very important. Find good mentors is very important. Find a mentor that already works in the field and can help you, guide you to where you need to go.
Mm-hmm.
Reading good books. Reading good essential design books, design from of everyday things,
yeah.
UX strategy, lean UX. There are more, but just look at who good big designers are. Look at name of good designers. Google them.
Mm-hmm.
Learn about their careers, what they've done before, who they were, what impact they did.
Mm-hmm.
Go to Twitter. Look at what designers are talking. Design Twitter is huge.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of designers on Twitter. Look
right.
at what they're posting on.
Yeah.
Go on Medium, read the blogs. But find a mentor to help you divide what is noise and what's signal. Otherwise,
mm-hmm.
you can get very lost on your career.
Yeah.
And once you have a good learning path and a good mentor to help you, I believe the best way of learning and getting to design is by doing. So
mm-hmm.
if it's not freelancing, as I said, it's a good way of learn by doing.
Mm-hmm.
I worked as an intern in a company called Sativa. The owner was one of the most amazing people I ever met. He also dropped out of college. He was a musician. He was very smart, but like a modern Renaissance man.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember he always got projects that he came to the team. We're very five people.
Mm-hmm.
And he came to the team and said, so there's this project that we need to do and deliver in a couple of months, 3 months. And we were like, okay, so we didn't know we never done this before. It was like, well, we had 3 months to find out
mm-hmm.
how to do it.
Mm. That's the right attitude.
And
yeah.
I think freelancing, there's a thing that I like that is you force... The stakes are so high that you kind of force yourself to succeed a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Like when, if it's not freelance, you need to be doing your own personal projects as a designer to build that portfolio.
Yeah.
Starting copying someone's work, it's a way of doing it, but only to the point where you start defining your own style or understanding what path do you want to take your career, but learn by doing your own projects. Sometimes you can get, I was talking about the habits and the struggles, you might just procrastinate a bit.
Mm-hmm.
When you get paid to do something, then the stakes are so high. Even though you get paid, someone pays you $50 to build
mm-hmm.
A website. And it's just the beginning of a career. You received to do that job, like you got paid. So it's like it's your job now.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to deliver on that time. You need to deliver good quality work that person is going to be happy with on that period of time, and that forces you to deliver something, which I think it's a good way of
mm-hmm.
of getting to the field, because you're going to need a portfolio if you're getting into design, if you want to find your first design job.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to add a bit of experience in with the design process.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to need to know the basics, know at least the basic literature or who a few good designers are, just to reference while you're talking about design.
Mm-hmm.
Even a couple of good Medium posts they read about design process, they're valuable if you can reference them. And you can do all of this. You're gonna need to do all of these steps if you freelance. So I think it's a good way of starting.
Right. Because this is one of the advices you gave to me last time when I asked if I don't have any local UX experience, how can I get a UX related job? So your advice is to create your own projects. That's also I'm keep thinking, and it's also because I used to do some projects before, and in China, because I when you immerse yourself in that environment, you will find some gap between a product and the user's need. But later when I moved to New Zealand, I found probably I don't have enough information. Like I don't know what actually users need here, and what kind of service or product I can create for them. It's like don't get really connect with the environment can limit the inspiration or limit the idea. So how do you think if I want to solve this problem, what kind of advice do you have about this?
I think that's the advice that I give to my team. It's being open to people, more open to people. I think one thing that I like to talk to my team is that designer is like being a doctor, right? It's not a role that you wear. It's not a hat that you wear where you are at work and then you take off. I think it comes from being interested about people and what people want and what people need. And we can only learn that by connecting with people on a day-to-day, or just in our day-to-day lives. Like, how often do we talk about empathy on a meeting and then we leave the meeting with our headphones on and don't speak with anyone?
How often
do we talk about doing a workshop on a retail store, but we never actually went to a retail store and spoke with the cashier, with the people at the checkout, with a person at the checkout, or with someone that was doing shopping and helped that person? So we need to be more open and connect with, like, that's the thing. We build technology, but that's not the end goal. The end goal is to deliver value to people. People are going to use that.
Yeah.
So they need to be our ultimate purpose of it. It's improve their lives. And we can only improve their lives if we know who they are.
That's right.
And then we need to, we can only know who they are if we speak with them. So, and sometimes we're just afraid of going to events because we want to talk with anyone, we don't want networking, but that's important. It's important to not only go to your field events, but what other interests that you have that you can go just to meet people and learn about things, learn about people, how people interact, how people relate, how people relate in the bus. How often do we are in a bus and sit alongside someone and go like and have a conversation about something? So I believe that's very important for designers to keep their mindset of being open with the environment that we have, because that also brings that sense of ethics and responsibility. We're designing for those people, we're connected with them, so that keeps us grounded and not designing some dark patterns or doing something that's gonna potentially harm those people through our technology. We need to be connected with the world and with people so we understand the responsibility of creating something that positively impacts the life of those people.
Yeah, that's quite true. Yeah, that's right. And also, this what you just said just remind me the stupid door we just met, we just found in the coffee shop. Like,
maybe the designer for that area doesn't really have a real connection with the cashier, the coffee maker, or the customer in that area. They don't know. He doesn't know the real environment or about the actual user's need. So for you guys, a reference that just Lucas and I met a few minutes an hour ago in a coffee shop, which has a really high technology door with digital codes, but also the code was written down on the and stick to on the door. So you can imagine just probably some customer keep asking the shopper about what the code it is, and they are really annoying, and probably they are too busy to answer the problems to answer the question, so they just write the code down and stick to the door. So which makes a gap between actual users and the products. So the high technology become a barrier on the road. So that's kind of problem you will not notice if you stay at home, listen to an L phone, or just not go to the real environment to see the real scenario and to connect with people.
There's a good saying back from the days of Lean Startup, that is, get out of the building. And Steve Blank used to use that quote a lot. He potentially still does. But I think it's very important for designers or for anyone working in technology, for that matter. That it's like you can't learn about the environment that you're designing if you don't get out of your meeting room and actually go to know and understand and empathize with the people they are designing for and the environment they are designing for.
Yeah,
like designing good products are not built in silos. They are part of very big complex systems, and we need to understand those big and complex systems in order to not have unwanted consequences of the products that we launch. We need to be aware of how the systems work, connect, and for your point, like with the door. That's a good example of lack of system thinking and understanding how that technology of the door connects with the entire environment of the coffee shop, and how the journey of someone going to the coffee shop happens. What are the pain points of the person that is delivering the coffee? Does she have time to give the password to everyone that's going to ask for the password? If not, what is the best use of technology to have at that door?
Yeah.
And that might be solved with a simple key that stays at the checkout, and then people ask for the key and open the door. It would be hundreds of dollars cheaper than that very complex technology. And maybe, I don't know, it's just giving a random example, but maybe more effective.
Yeah.
And we're looking at, because basic human need, we're developed things to fulfill basic human needs, and they're very complex but also beautifully simple to understand and to fulfill with our products. They require so much less than what we think they require. Just to think about the products they love using, they're probably not very complex. They probably don't add any complexity to your life. Completely the opposite. They take out complexity from your life and make you just focus on the essential.
We already take a really long time to talk, and probably I'll just keep it short for last two questions.
Yeah,
and I don't want to take a lot of time from you today. Actually, this question is about it's more like a personal advice, and I would like to hear from you. It's like I worked for a company as a multimedia designer for a while, and then I did a lot of marketing related jobs, and also before that, I found my passion and my career should be related to UX and UI design. So, and then I just left my job last month, and now at this stage, I'm looking for UX, UI design related jobs for nearly a month. But I think courses normally you can't get it immediately when you apply it and get interview and things. It's not that fast. And so after 1 month, I'm in a normal situation. It's like keep focus on looking for UX, UI related jobs, or I can apply some marketing related jobs and try to improve my skills and looking for the opportunities later. So probably when I get ready, or when there's there were other opportunities occur in UX and UI design jobs, I can change the career. So I'm just in the middle of this options. So and I found it's really hard to choose both, no matter which one. So do you have any advice for that situation?
Do a pros and cons list.
It's kind of like that.
I always do a pros and cons list to decide to make decisions, but I don't have a very specific answer because I don't want to be responsible for a decision that you make. But one thing that I like to do, have you heard about the regret, what is it, regret minimization framework from Jeff Bezos, that he talks about every decision, big decision that he's going to make. I'm not sure if that's the right name, but he talks about every big decision that he's going to make. He imagined himself a few years later, looking back and thinking about which one of those paths would I regret more, not taking it, or which one of those decisions would I regret more, not doing it. And then the one that he thinks he would regret more, he goes for it. So I think I'm very rational on decisions. So, and for everyone that's making decisions, I think speaking with people in the field, just to understand what is the difference between the two paths that you can take, or people that already took those paths, or people that already been to the same crosswords that you've been, doing a pros and cons list, and evaluating what are the consequences of making those choices, and what are the struggles involved in to achieve the goals that you want to achieve. And then from that, you make your call and hope for the best. And if you make the wrong call, you go back and choose something else. I think there's always time to reinvent ourselves and to iterate on our own personal processes. We're never
It's like design process.
Our life is a design. Learning is a design process. Imagine that learning is just you can fit a learning process into the double diamond. It is a learning process.
That's right.
The lean startup, it is a learning process. You build, you measure, you learn, then you build again. You measure, you learn. It's always a cycle of learning. You try something, work, measure, receive feedback. Did it work? Did it not work? Why? And then you learn from it, and then you do it better, or you try to do something else.
Cool. Thank you for your advice. So one last question, let's pick a really easy one. What could you describe your typical day as a designer? So like from the start to the end of your day?
So my day now as a design, head of design, group head of design, it's focusing on people more than on the tools. Which is a quite big transition when you stop being a designer from skills and you start managing designers. So my day consists basically in checking with people from my team, either having one-on-one meetings to see how they're going, if there's something that I can improve on their lives, checking how they're growing inside their careers.
Mm-hmm.
I have a couple of meetings with big clients often. Wait, you were talking about before coming to work as well, or no?
No.
Yeah, so all right. So when I arrive at work, yeah, that's it. So it's just usually have my coffee and then go check in with people from the team, see how they're doing, see how they're progressing on their learning, if there's something I can do to help them or not. And then I go to do some administrative tasks. Recently, I'm spending a lot of time looking at portfolios.
Mm-hmm.
I spend a lot of my day looking at portfolios just to see how good other people are so I can bring to my team or we can bring to other... I have a folder just with good portfolios from people that I might ask to come work with me someday.
Mm.
I think it's part of the job. And then, it's already almost fuels my day. And then some days I have workshops with clients to help them make some big, tough decisions around business design and their products.
Mm-hmm.
I go to a lot of demo meetings. We do design critiques. So it's usually around those leadership tasks more than to be fair, yesterday I did some posters for our design principles. We did a workshop with the team defining our design principles and it was just refining some posters.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was a fun part of my day, doing a bit of fun part of the day, just because I think it's important not to lose touch with the craft.
Mm-hmm.
So once in a while, I still jump in products if the team is okay with it, just to work as a designer on the tools again.
Mm-hmm.
It's a boost of motivation for me. But mostly, I do that through workshops or design sprints now.
Mm.
Yeah,
I think that's all for today. Because probably
cool.
Next time there are some other questions, but I think that's enough for today. And really, thank you for your time, and also for all the guys are listening. And if you want to know more about Lucas, probably they can follow your LinkedIn or your website.
Yeah,
how they can
connect. That's a good question. I think, do you know my website? I don't remember what my website is. It's lucascoelho.me.
Co.
That's true.
Yeah.
lucascoelho.co.
Yeah, because I just checked that before this.
I don't update that often, that's why I don't remember. But lucascoelho.co. And yeah, Lucas Coelho on LinkedIn, at Coelho Lucas on Twitter. And feel free to add me and we can chat.
Yeah. And thank you guys, thank you for listening, and I will see you in another episode. Okay, bye.
Bye.
本期节目由高效阅读课程赞助播出。阅读没有用了，这是这个时代关于阅读的一个最大谎言。恰恰相反，在信息时代呢，阅读书籍的能力正变得前所未有的重要。那些领先的成功者们，不论是西方的杰弗里·贝索斯、马克·扎克伯格、埃伦·马斯克、沃伦·巴菲特、比尔·盖茨，还是国内的马云、王石等等行业领袖们，都是通过大量阅读书籍来获取有效知识和信息的学习者。在这个时代， Leaders are readers， 领导者都是阅读者。大狗熊我呢，在6年前隐约意识到了这个关于阅读的真相，并且投入了大量的时间和精力来锻炼自己的阅读能力和技巧，也陆续在节目里分享了很多具体的读书感受。但我发现更值得分享的呢，是我这套独创的高效阅读方法。所以呢，我将自己的阅读经验和方法呢，历时几个月整理为这门高效阅读的精华专题课程。这门课程一共包含12节，每一节呢会针对性的讨论一个关于阅读的问题。学习完之后呢，你可以做到一年阅读100本 优质的非虚构类书籍，并且培养起适合自己的阅读习惯与输出应用的技巧，成为学习上的超人。一年100本书，这个听起来好像很恐怖，但只要按照课程里所教授的方法一步一步去做，是完全可以做到的。大狗熊，我在6月到8月这3个月里呢，同时在制作课程，也在上班工作，然后还要带小孩，然后还要做播客的节目等等，每天只有很有限的阅读的时间，但即便这样，3个月的时间呢，也阅读了30多本书。所以这套方法有难度也有挑战，你想轻松速成的话就请走开，但一旦掌握的话，它将随着时间的增加而变得越来越熟练。越早学会高效阅读呢，你就越早能从阅读中收益。马上登录高效阅读的官网 readwithbear.com， read R-E-A-D with W-I-T-H bear B-E-A-R.com， 或者呢关注微信公众号狗熊有话说，可以查看详情。每张课程的第一节呢都可以免费的观看。狗熊有话说的听友都有5元的优惠券赠送，在狗熊有话说这个公众号啊，这个公众号里面呢回复高效阅读就可以领取优惠券。高效阅读，想学习想提升想成长的你值得来加入。
Save big money at Menards. Gorilla tapes, glues, and adhesives are perfect for jobs around the house, indoors and out. Gorilla Heavy Duty Construction Adhesive has a 100% waterproof formula that provides a secure bond on any surface. From trim work to landscape block to hanging mirrors, it's all purpose and holds in 30 seconds. Pick it up for your project and head to Menards.com to see all of our great deals going on now.
Save big money at Menards.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast.Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.